Welcome back to Emerge. On this episode, I'm speaking with Gail Bradbrook. Gail is one of the founders of Extinction Rebellion, one of the most exciting political movements happening on the planet that I'm aware of, at least at the moment. And so it's with great pleasure and really an honor to be bringing Gail and sharing her story, as well as the larger story and vision of Extinction Rebellion with you. And I think, as you'll hear, this is, I think, a political movement that intersects with many of the conversations we've been having on this show over the past couple of years. And so I think it's wonderful to see this emerging in the world. Really brings to life some of the conversations that I've had here on Emerge. And so if you'd like to support the podcast, there are two major ways you can do that. The first is by becoming a supporting listener by clicking on the link in the show notes or by going to anchor.fm/emerge. There you can make a 99-cent or $5 a month or $10 a month contribution. It helps me pay the various digital costs of creating this, as well as gives me more time to do the research and do the production, reimburses me for that time. The other way you can support the podcast is by leaving a review on iTunes. Those reviews actually really support new listeners encountering this show. The algorithms in their wisdom use those reviews as a way to decide who sees what on the internet. And so it really makes a difference if you want to support the show. To leave a quick review on iTunes, it doesn't take much time at all, and it's very appreciated. Okay, I hope you enjoy this episode of Emerge with Gail Bradbrook. Welcome back to Emerge. On this episode of the show, I'm very excited to welcome Gail Bradbrook, who is one of the founders of Extinction Rebellion in the United Kingdom. Extinction Rebellion is a group that believes that time has run out to address the ecological crisis. And in the face of this, it's the right and duty of every citizen to rebel and for the government to tell the truth and decarbonize the economy in as short a period of time as possible. And so even from that very brief elevator pitch, listeners can hear how resonant this is with all of the inquiries that we've been going through on this show. And so I first encountered the Extinction Rebellion on October 31st. And it was very interesting. I think I was riding on a bus to go fly to California for an event out in America. And you know, while I'm over here, I'm connected with a number of Europeans through this podcast. And it seemed like all at once, everyone was talking about this event and this organization. And then I read what's called the Declaration of Rebellion, which was, I believe, released on the same day on October 31st. And I knew in my bones that this was going to be something special. I knew in the same way that I sort of knew when I saw Occupy Wall Street, that this was something that was just like true and good and appropriate and like just right timing. And since then, Extinction Rebellion seems to be growing, at least from my perspective, more or less exponentially. In 1 month since they've begun, or at least since they've launched, they've shut down more or less the city of London through direct action, performed, I can't even keep track, it's seemingly innumerable direct actions within London and throughout the UK, and getting lots of coverage in major news outlets like The Guardian and the BBC. And just to, you know, kind of, I think it's just so important to keep presencing this as we do so often on the show. And you know, we can't give a big picture, but, you know, a recent New York Times article I saw called the Insect Apocalypse. You know, scientists recently found the population of monarch butterflies fell by 90%. In the last 20 years, that's a loss of 900 million individuals. And so, you know, just that's another piece, just to bring us into the presence of the reality of the Anthropocene and this mass extinction that we're going through. And so really happy to have Gail here to kind of share with us what is happening with the Extinction Rebellion. And before we launch into the conversation, it's important to say, and I recall saying things like this with Occupy Wall Street, that Gail is not here to speak as Extinction Rebellion or for Extinction Rebellion. She's here to speak on behalf of herself as an individual. And so, Gail, welcome to Emerge.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great. And so I guess the first question we wanted to start off with is just like, how did you come to be involved with Extinction Rebellion? Can you tell us a little bit that story?
So I guess I've been interested in social change for many years. It feels like since I was a little girl, if I'm honest. I've got interested in animal rights. As a young one, I guess it was a deep feeling that something was wrong in the world, and somehow that can get a bit tied up in knots as well as you grow up and you have to figure some of that out. Around 2008, birth of my second child, something strong was emerging in me in wanting to contribute. And in 2010, I was involved in the tax justice movement and spotting the deep inequality in the world. I did a lot of research around economics and so on. It was clear to me that mass civil disobedience was appropriate. And what I would say, I suppose, is that I failed a lot. I tried a lot of different things and they didn't work. I read a lot of books. Mm. I went on various trainings. And eventually, I was part of Occupy Democracy, which was the thing that happened after Occupy and so on. I've read Mika White's book. I've read This Is an Uprising, you know, lots of things. And I think I got to a stage, actually, before some of that reading, where I was just feeling a little bit, I don't know if desperate is quite the right word, but recognizing there was something not right in me that I was bringing to the table. And I think that's really important. You know, activism to me is something that's internal as well as external. Mm. And also, I didn't think I had all the right information, and I didn't think I had all the right people around me. Apart from that, everything was going fine. And so I went to do a retreat. I went to pray. Although I have a background in science, I have a pagan leaning. I don't know if I fully own that title. I always feel a little bit at odds with any of these things, but I do sort of sit with ceremony and things like that. And it got to a stage where I felt a need to go and really call to the universe, if you like, for help. Mm. And as somebody with some environmental leanings, I don't take flying that lightly. I know it's a little bit more common in the States, but I did fly to Costa Rica and carbon tax myself before anybody criticizes me for it, but with a donation to Tree Sisters. And I went to do a big retreat there, working with Iboga and ayahuasca. And it's quite an interesting story if you want me to tell it, what happened.
Yes, please. I would love to hear it.
So I guess the Iboga, it was with New Life, Ayahuasca New Life, Iboga, a retreat center I really recommend. The Iboga was a flood dose, and that was to look at some internal issues around, I suppose, addiction wasn't running my life at that stage, but it was there in the background, busyness, not feeling quite right, anxiety. Mm-hmm. And the journey with Iboga was just incredible. And to cut a long story short there, it rewired my brain. What an incredible plant medicine. And then with the ayahuasca, I guess it was more of an external prayer. And I was frankly crapping myself taking that level of psychedelic medicine. So I'd been listening to a lot of Terence McKenna podcasts and trying to figure out how to cope with it and getting some good advice from Terence from beyond the grave. I did feel like he visited me actually in the Iboga. That's probably because I've been thinking about him so much. And he was talking about the codes in the higher consciousness. And I have no idea really, but I was sort of thinking, well, surely there must be some codes for social change. You know, how are we supposed to go about this thing? What does it look like? What are the codes for social change? So that was very specifically my prayer with the ayahuasca. Who's in my team? Can I meet more people? What do I need to be doing with my time? I'm here in service and so on. And then I came back to the UK and I tried to launch a mass tax disobedience, made a little short video. That was another flop. I mean, it sort of went semi-viral, but it didn't really work. But another valiant attempt, I think. But off the back of trying that, Roger Hallam contacted me, who's a researcher at King's College, and I guess another fellow nerd interested in concepts and how things work and so on. And he invited me to a meeting and we met, and it ended up being a 4-hour meeting. He said he had a headache at the end of it. Mm-hmm. And it was a real meeting of minds and a sharing of information and what we understood. So he was doing research at that time in what he was calling conditional commitment, which is I'll do something if you'll do it. And so he'd managed to help organise a successful rent strike at University College London, which was the first successful rent strike in ages. And so he was interested in this conditional commitment idea, and I'd actually set up a platform to host conditional commitments. And so he was sharing a lot of his data. It was a real nerd off, graphs and so on. Data, here's how not to do something. Well, you're getting this right, Gail, but you should think about this. And so it went on, and we shared ideas about what we wanted to do and how committed we were to social change and all the rest of it. And then at the end of this 4-hour period, I just says, you know, Roger, I can't believe this meeting is exactly everything that I needed to know. And he leaned over and he tapped my notepad and he said, basically, Gail, what I've just given you here are the codes for social change. So he actually used the phrase of the prayer, and I realized afterwards I wouldn't have realized that it was the delivery of the prayer. It's like the grandmother ayahuasca had to tap me on the shoulder and go, by the way, Gail, just pay attention. I did actually deliver on that request. So then we started trying to set up an organization called Rising Up. There was Roger in particular organized a lot of meetings with activists. I think I'd been trying to work with kind of relatively grassroots NGOs, and that's not the right place. So we had activists from Earth First, from Occupy, from Plain Stupid in the UK, from Reclaim the Power in lots of different meetings. And Roger presented his ideas around strategies, and we wrote a strategy together as a group, and that's what got things going.
Cool. And you know, I think now there's a lot of information on the internet about what Extinction Rebellion is. And there's a lot of now news coverage, which I'm extremely pleased to see, about what it is. And I'm curious for you, Gail, like, what does it mean to you?
I mean, what it means to me personally is the realization of a dream. You know, it's the idea to try and start a social movement. And obviously, who knows what's going to happen. There's a really, really dedicated team of people want to make this work. And we know that we've got to change how we're doing things now. It's gone from a small team to huge. It feels a bit like I've given birth. And I don't mean it's just me personally. Hopefully I'm saying this with some humility. You know, I mean, it was an incredible period focused on getting this thing moving. And at the same time, it's a period of such utter grief because, you know, I was in court in January. I'd been arrested at a frack site in Lancashire just as part of a contribution towards the anti-fracking movement in the UK. And so I'd done a lot of research with Polly Higgins' team from Mission Life Force about getting a defence together. And I'd, you know, done lots of research about the state of the ecosystem and ecocides and so on. But I realised that I hadn't really faced what we're dealing with. I just thought I had. And I think that I suspect that a lot of campaigners and environmentalists, I suspect that a lot of us do it from our intellect rather than from our heart, even though the heart's obviously going to come into it sometimes. So what it also means for me is a lot of grief, you know. So it's a kind of time of my life, and also, you know, it's like being told that your kids are going to die soon or something, you know, something really painful like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the things that like leapt out at me. And I don't even know if it was anything I saw or anything that was like said in words when I was reading about Extinction Rebellion, but was, it felt like it was arising out of somewhere that acknowledges the grief and wasn't purely intellectual, but instead was like deeply human and even more than human in the way that, I don't know. And now I've subsequently like seen some of the kind of events around it that affirm that, but I could just tell that it was coming from a different place. And it's really, really striking. It has a completely different vibe than I feel like I've ever seen before with this sort of thing. So, to what degree was this kind of meeting of trauma and grief an intentionally placed ingredient in Extinction Rebellion? And to what degree did it arise emergently? And yeah, can you tell me a little bit more about that whole piece? I'm curious.
Yeah, I think it's a mixture. I mean, the declaration itself was drafted by Simon Bramwell, who's also my boyfriend and has a deep spiritual basis to his practice as well. I wouldn't say everybody in Extinction Rebellion does, and we want to be really inclusive in how we present ourselves so that, you know, if you're a hardened atheist or even not hardened, you know, lots of atheists are quite spiritual in my view, but anyway, that you feel that you can be part of that. There was an acknowledgement of, I mean, the way we sort of say it is we're fucked. For a British way of saying things, in fact, we did a banner drop with "We're fucked," you know, and so that was already in the room, and that the acknowledgement that there was the innovation came from Roger that it was time to tell the truth and ask people to act as if the truth was real, and he got together a talk, and I think when as I did the research for the talk, he had a very spiritual leaning in that anyway, in terms of saying this is really painful to hear. And as I read it and thought about redrafting it, I felt that the science needed tightening up and so on. I wanted to bring people in like Stephen Jenkinson, because again, a little bit coming from Simon, talking about being a worthy ancestor, you know, there's something that shifted in me in the process of preparing for Extinction Rebellion that was about, you know, I think I was being quite self-righteous, actually. I was being, you know, doing that activist, put activism at the centre of my life. You can be really up your own arse about it in a way, can't you? Look at me, I'm cool, I'm doing this stuff, you're not doing enough, and all that business. And after a bit, it's like, whoa, hang about. This is not about me. This is not about anybody. This is about life on Earth, and it's dying. And what does it mean to be an alive human being? I mean, I think what shifted for me when I really let the grief in and expressed it and did some processing, some more processing around it. It's not like I've never processed grief about the Earth, but did the next phase of that, was a feeling of wanting to be a worthy ancestor, a feeling of wanting to get me out of the way, and real need for community, a real need to have that be held and met by other people. Otherwise, a slight feeling of going bonkers, you know.
What's your sense, or what's your experience of what encountering and sort of either, I don't know how you want to frame it, working through experiencing that grief and that trauma, what does that open up as for us as activists or people? The world.
Yeah. I mean, I've written an article that's yet to be published. I think The Guardian might do it, but anyway, it's called "Grief, Love, and Data: The Foundations of a New Social Movement." And a new friend, Kofi, is saying it's more trauma. Actually, I mean, we're traumatized about what we're doing, I think, and how we've been living, and it's kind of like, I suppose, being a privileged white Westerner. It means there's also a lot of comfort on offer, isn't there? There's a way to deal with that. And mm-hmm. even the kind of, let's call it the NGO therapy industrial complex or something, there's a place where you can get all into doing your nature connection retreat and going off and doing this, that, and the other. And even with all of that, it can be a holding pattern. And I think Stephen just says it really well, that if you want to focus on feeling well, don't focus on these times, because it's not consistent. You know, it doesn't mean you can't have fun and so on, but, you know, grief is and trauma is part of it if you let that to the surface. So I had this other interesting experience. I actually help host a moon circle for women. We meet with a full moon, a little bit based in the Red Path tradition, but separated from that. And so we have a TP that we use, and I hope people don't feel we've appropriated anything. There has been a lineage and a gifting of a design, but anyway, I was feeling really at odds with my community in Stroud. We're a transition town, if that means something to you. We think about changing the economy. We're a anthroposophical community, lots of Rudolf Steiner type of schools and health things here and so on. And so it's quite a forward-thinking town. And I was just feeling at odds with most of the people in my community, not understanding what I was planning, also feeling quite frustrated at people who, in principle, care about the earth but aren't willing to go and stand outside a frack site and risk being arrested and so on. So it's been a bit of an ongoing feeling. So I took some there's a plant in the UK that the apparently the Celts would have prayed with called mugwort. It's from the Artemisia family, and went and had a meeting with some of the young women from Extinction Rebellion, and we to just host some prayers and do some bonding in this teepee anyway. But I put up a prayer actually for support from my community. I was feeling really quite frustrated, and it was incredible. 2 days later, my friend Skeena Rathor came back, texted me to say, Gail, we've got to meet. I've just been with Jem Bendel, who you probably know wrote the Deep Adaptation paper. And she'd been in this conference in Cumbria University, jointly hosted by Jem's people and some folks, some German folks. And she said, I've never been to anything like it, Gail. People in tears, grown men, professors in suits crying. The latest climate science was presented. It completely opened her eyes. Again, another person who would have thought they were on top of this stuff. And also they were presenting I don't know if they were presenting data, but they were talking about data and some of the feedback from scientists in the Arctic at the minute, who were talking about the possible buildup of an El Nino event over the Arctic that could result in a collapse in the food systems in 3 years' time. So she came back in incredible shock, but it was also a real gift to me, because she started going around my community going, why are we not listening to Gail? And suddenly everything shifted in Stroud. And Stroud District Council's now, I mean, I'm talking about early September, right? Stroud District Council last 2 weeks has just announced itself as that we're in a climate crisis. And that came off the back of a whole pile of activism that's just emerged in Stroud. Stroud's just suddenly changed. It's really quite incredible. There's an ongoing occupation. So there's something about the foundational work that people have done, I think, but also the shock that says, actually, climate change is not something that's happening to somebody else somewhere else at another time. You know, and we all feel bad about that, but we're not really that bothered because it's not in our face and it's not about our kids. And I can just own that as much as anybody else. I do care about climate justice, but, you know, there's also that thing of, what's most in your heart is your own children's future and so on. So this shift happened. Yeah. This shift happened, and yeah, what I was going to say is, I think it's the shift in consciousness. I think it could be there's this idea, if you read, I think it's wonderful, you know, people like Charles Eisenstein and so on. This is a sort of sense of this long arc of progress where people find their way. They find their place in the world, and they contribute to this change process. But there's a place where that's just not fast enough, and so on, and not to make everybody feel urgent. There's something about facing this grief that feels like it kickstarts you into the, if you're interested in spiral dynamics that Ken Wilber talks about, theory of everything, that kind of stuff. It feels like it. This has been my experience, and what I feel like I'm watching others doing, moving into teal. In terms of, you know, what Ken says, the issue for the progressive left, the green progressive left, is narcissism. It's all about us. You know, we're in a consumer culture, and it feels, at least it's done part of a job of kicking me out of that, and I can see that in others.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I think I feel that too. And it does seem like there's some kind of shift in the foundations of our collective consciousness right now. And it's so hard to know, you know, because I pay attention to the sources of information that I pay attention to. But even in my peer groups, people who don't know about Extinction Rebellion, people who are kind of less plugged in than I am, seem to be newly comprehending the potentiality of collapse and extinction and crisis. And for me, I've noticed that really, and you know, this part of the reason I did this podcast is like to force myself to take these issues seriously, but to really reckon with these possibilities almost necessarily reorients your life. And I guess I'm curious, like you're in a position where you're kind of holding space for that to happen on a massive scale. And it's hard even sometimes with my friends to sort of bring it up and to have them and to interact around this. Like there's just a lot there. And I'm curious, like what do you have any perspective on like how to approach this topic in a way that gives you a greater likelihood to break through perhaps into a sort of teal consciousness or teal orientation versus a kind of breakdown? Because I notice myself, I oscillate. Like sometimes I give up hope and then sometimes it's inspiring and kind of lights a fire under my butt. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I like Derek Jensen talks about hopium. You know, there's something about hope that kind of, it's just a bit vague, isn't it? That you just hope something's going to be okay. I suppose Joanna Macy brought forward the idea of active hope, the hope that comes through doing things. One of the things we've talked about in Extinction Rebellion is virtue ethics, is doing the right thing. Because one of the kind of pressures of neoliberalism, I guess, is to do things because it's going to get you something. You know, it's the sort of opposite of community, isn't it? And the gift economy, it's to just do this and you might get that thing. And whilst there is some really strong theories of change in what we're doing, and we're using momentum-driven organising, we've been learning from people in the States, people like Carlos Saavedra from Aini Institute trained some of us and so on. You know, beyond that, we're just saying, let's not be too attached to the outcome and let's just feel like this is the right thing to be doing and let's see, because who knows what humanity can come up with. And then to go back to your original point about how you have these conversations, because it can feel really quite alienating being around friends that are in the other world where they're not thinking about that stuff. I do find that hard these days. And I've just started to name it. I've just started to say to friends, I feel a bit alienated. And see what they make of that. A good friend of mine advised me, if in terms of talking about climate change or anything that's difficult, to talk about it with people. So to say to people, if we were going to have a conversation about climate change, ecological crisis, you know, the risk of human extinction, what would that be like for you, just having that conversation? So don't launch into having it. Ask them and see where it sits for them, because they may say, well, I'll be really frightened, or I don't want to think about it, or I'm worried, you know, then that makes the room to see whether the conversation's going to happen or not. I think one of the things I've had to deal with myself around is, I was calling Hermione a teenager who wants to tell people off and wants to tell everybody what to do. She was getting in the way. I sort of need to get her to step back and go and play in the woods or something. And just actually be respectful of people's right to consent in terms of conversations and so on. Not that I've been forcing this down anybody's throat either, but you know what? You can be quite, when something's on your mind, just slipping it in the conversation, aren't you? I think to own it a bit more. Like, I really feel like I want to talk to you about this. It's feeling like a barrier in our relationship that we're not having a conversation about this. It is one thing. Yeah. And then I guess you also, sorry, mentioned the whole thing of opening up this space and holding it. And what's just been incredible is, because I think a lot of people have been waiting for this moment to come, is that people are coming with their gifts and their skills. And so you've got somebody like Gayano Shaw, who's set up something called Brokenhearted, the skill of brokenheartedness in the wake of the XR Declaration, and has been offering online support. And I would just, you know, one of the things that's absolutely the case with Extinction Rebellion is, if you agree with our principles and values, and there's 10 of them and they're mentioned online, things like nonviolence and regenerative culture and so on, and you want to start something in the name of Extinction Rebellion, that you just literally need no permission, you just totally feel free. And so if people want to start sharing circles that they feel is needed in the wake of that, or the space that's been opened up, and the space that's been opened up because of the IPCC and what the UN said this summer, and the wildfires and the floods. I mean, it's not obviously just Extinction Rebellion. I think we've hit a bit of a zeitgeist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so one other piece of this is kind of related that I'd love to hear your thoughts on is, I struggle, and I notice a lot of people in this space struggle with this kind of movement between a sense of profound urgency and the kind of acknowledgement that life will take its time to unfold this process, right? Like, we're kind of here in service of life. And so I don't know, there's this kind of like space between not rushing and not hesitating, that seems like you are, or Extinction Rebellion is doing a very good job of occupying. And it's hard in my world to do that as an individual. And I'm curious, like, what it's like to attempt to kind of create that context of relaxed urgency, almost, it seems, in even a movement. Like, where there's space for emotional healing, and yet, you know, the world is on fire.
Yeah. Well, I think that sometimes people come to me who know me and say, "Gail, I want to get involved," and I can hear that edge of panic in them, that they need to feel like they're doing something to feel better. And I say, well, you know, maybe you need to go and get some support with how you're feeling about it, you know, as a first thing, because I do think that the deeper commitment to this process comes from love, you know, and love is grief is the price of love, you know. So again, it's what Charles Eisenstein talks about in his new book, Climate, A New Story. You know, we're going to protect the earth when we love her. So I don't know whether it's fast or slow. I think that's the indication. That's an indication for me about where I'm at with the movement at any one time is am I in my heart or not, or am I getting all it's like, okay, Gail, maybe you need to, I can take a few hours off or something, or go for a walk or reconnect with something. So I do love that quote, "Organize at the speed of trust." I think that came out of Black Lives Matters. And I think people, it's useful if people organize in their communities. And this has not been sort of signed off internally yet, but I made a recent proposal that we think of the unfolding of this movement as two potential paths. One is the one that we're more openly organizing towards at the minute, which is the idea of rebellion, declaring yourself in rebellion with your government, breaking the social contract in that way, and committing acts of civil disobedience to create a political crisis. And then the idea would be that you'd be in the room with the government. We do already have a political team waiting for that moment. That's been something you can learn from other social movements, through James Sharp or Tim G's writings. That people don't always get ready for that moment. They don't plan for success. Excuse me. So there's that path that's sort of the more traditional political path. And that would be really welcome, obviously, because we need to move. We do need to be making shifts ASAP in terms of policies and so on. But I guess for me, the second path that I see, and both can happen, right, but is that collapse will come. People like Jen Bendel do talk about it being inevitable. It seems to be, who knows, but, you know, that is the precedent for civilizations, is that they collapse rather than sustain themselves. So I guess the other piece I feel like is by having a network of awake people focused on building community and building their own sense of agency at a local level, that's what's needed. It's not somebody else's job, you know, that food. Like if you take this transition movement, which I was strongly involved with for 4 years, and we got things like Edible Stroud off the ground with planted trees, with food trees and so on. I feel like a lot of that was, I feel like a lot of things that we might have done in the past were like children playing at something to prepare ourselves. I kind of feel like we've got to grow up now, and it's not playground anymore. It's sort of shit or bust time. So I don't know if that really answers your question about speed, but the point is that if it's not done from love and community, I just don't think it's going to sustain itself. I mean, there is an internal energy within Extinction Rebellion and Rising Up that's very forward and probably in the sort of masculine, if you like. And then there's a feminine that kind of tries to make sure that the building blocks are in place. And there's always that kind of tension inside that's, it's its best is a really creative tension. You know, when is it time to breathe and push, and when is it time to exhale and settle and inhale and relax and so on. And I think that's something we have to constantly balance.
Yeah. Thank you for speaking to that. I think it's, organizing at the speed of trust is beautiful. Even though sometimes the speed of trust, I think, is slower than our minds might want and our sense of urgency might desire. But, things tend to fall apart if you try to go faster than that. Like I saw that at Occupy. Like we kind of tried to grow too quickly. We tried to do too many things too quickly. And the sort of trust between the people broke down. And, you know, that's something I'd love to hear you reflect on is it seemed like my experience at Occupy was there was this really beautiful core of people who got together to launch it. And they had built trust together through hardship and through lots of work together. And then more people started coming on, more people were called forth. And the system, the kind of social network couldn't hold in the same way. And trust started to break down at some point. And there's lots of reasons for that, from agent provocateurs to police violence and, you know, reasons. But I'm curious, like, what your thoughts are and how to preserve trustworthy relationships as the movement, at least from my perspective, seems to be growing like exponentially.
Yeah, I'd really love to have a conversation with some occupiers about that experience, because that's the first time I've heard it expressed as a thing that Occupy experienced. I mean, you sort of read the notes about why Occupy didn't work, as maybe because it only had one tactic or whatever. You hear different things, but I think it would be incredibly useful for some of our core team to hear about that. So yeah, I'd welcome that. It is a relatively difficult time right now. I mean, that in social change theory, as I understand it, you call it a moment of the whirlwind. That's what Carlos Saavedra told us. So we've had this big whoosh, and to my mind, we need to really accept that there's a slump in energy afterwards. People are really tired. There's a lot of people that, you know, there's some critiques out there. Some of them are totally reasonable. Some of them are probably got some good information in them, but they come across quite aggressively. And there's a lot coming at us as a group. Mm-hmm. And we were 15 of us in a room in May planning this thing. So, you know, there's now thousands of people wanting to help organize, never mind just be involved, you know. And we know that if we're going to take up Erica Chenoweth's data, we need about 3.4% of the population. It's about 2 million people in the UK for the shift. There's groups going across the world. And, there are different levels of skills in terms of building that trust. And it's a bit of an ongoing dialogue at the minute to get us to slow down. I heard a decision got unmade today, which I'm really glad about, on that basis, actually, of the push, where actually we need to keep reconnecting as a team. And it's difficult because we started off as a what do you call it? A dictatorship of the most willing. I think it gets called, you know, whoever's doing things is just because they were the ones willing to work for free and just, you know, try this crazy idea out. Right. And now there's just a lot of people want to get involved. Money's coming through the crowdfunder. In principle, we could just expand really quickly. And it does feel to me a mistake if we don't really think about what form we want to have going forwards. And I guess on that basis, I'd refer to Adrian Murray Brown's book, Emergent Strategy, about what fractal are we creating right now? You know, what does that look like? What's the basis of that? So we have a meeting in Stroud tomorrow to talk about decentralization. And if people on this listening to this podcast are part of Extinction Rebellion or want to be, exciting news, or I'm excited about it, is that Mickey Kashtan is giving us some group coaching that people can join. That's going to be starting on the 14th of December. Do you know Mickey?
I don't know.
Oh, she's like some super uber cool facilitator, groundbreaking thing, because she's written about Occupy and knows a lot about decentralizing. And it feels like a de-schooling of our brains that are needed. So, I mean, I you know, I wasn't in Occupy to know, but be really interested to know how that was, in terms of, because, you know, Occupy Stroud got off the ground. There was occupations everywhere, weren't there, or people using that name, and then it kind of fizzled out. You know, I don't know what that was exactly about, but it feels like how do you support the DNA or the fractal to have a good shape without telling people what to do? You know, it's people have to be self-ordered, don't they? So,
yeah. Well, I mean, even that, hearing that you know about like sort of spiral dynamics and I think I saw on at least the Rising Up Google Doc, I saw that you're using some kind of holocratic structures. Is that right?
We're using holocracy in the sense of, you know, if somebody's in charge of something, they're asked to get advice and feedback from a few people before they make a decision. But we haven't embedded a full holocracy. We just had an hour's advice from somebody called Nick Osborne recently about how we might go about that. But we're also trying to look at other systems, because it feels, you know, it's just finding the right model, really, for us.
But. Yeah. Well, I would say that there's the fact that you're not trying to do this through consensus, which I think hopefully we've all learned by now, you know, isn't a scalable decision-making technology. Just for instance, it says to me that this is emerging out of a kind of different sensibility. And it's interesting, you know, you framed it as perhaps just a clear acknowledgement of the possibility and probability of extinction, kind of ups the ante a little bit and makes us put on a kind of, I would almost say, like, feel more adult about it. Like that they're, and I think, you know, one thing that I remember at Occupy, or my sense was that what happened at Occupy, part of what happened, now there's so much that happened, but it was that people were too willing to give away their power. Like the people that actually started it, they were too quickly to say, oh, we're leaderless. Oh, there's, you know, nobody is any better or different than anybody else. But like, no, there are actually natural hierarchies that would have well served the movement, I think, to have been maintained, right? It was, and that's the kind of, I think, you know, in spiral dynamics term, this kind of postmodern move where it's just a kind of flattening and desire to include everybody instead of making sometimes hard but necessary decisions around these sorts of questions. And it sounds like you are positioning or Extinction Rebellion is positioning itself as it to not fall into those traps, which is very exciting to hear.
So that's what we're focused on at the minute, obviously wanting to support groups that want to get off the ground and share information about what we've done so far and that kind of thing, and keeping actions going where people want to take action, not wanting to squash energy in that way, but very much for me reviewing what we've done and restructuring and moving in the direction of decentralization. I don't know enough to comment to in a detailed way on it, but what I think I've understood so far is that, yeah, that emergence of hierarchy, so that you'd have lots of people in lots of different teams, like you might have a legal team or a training team or a media team or whatever, you know, and from within that they'll be within networks of networks, and that let's say we want to say there's going to be a strategy day or there's going to be an action, when, what date should it be, what format should it take, that needs to take intelligence from the system. And I guess the people that will do the thinking, you know, will do their better thinking when they've got like the hive mind behind them, but are still empowered to make the decision at the end of the day. So what we're doing at the minute is moving in the direction of dissolving the coordination team, but into a few other groups and bringing some other people in there for the time being. So that's still a bit, you know, top down, but it's to just try and we've ended up with too many of us in one meeting. That just never works that well. So what makes me really excited, Daniel, is if we figure this out, if we figure out how do you actually have a genuine system where the power is decentralized in a really good way, the decisions are made by the right people in the right way, you know, and I'm sure there'll be fuck-ups, of course, but, you know, that even if there is, the system learns from it and improves. Talking to Mickey about that, and also we've got a team of potential advisors, like I think Frederick Laloux's been willing to offer advice on specific questions, and I think Adrienne's been asked, and other people like that. Boy, you know, tangent, but I do feel like the universe is looking after me. And I was thinking, I looked at this amazing team of advisors. I gave a talk in Stroud, and I've been thinking, feels like we're missing somebody who's probably worked more closely with industry, you know, in industry. And blow me, this professor from UCL comes up, shoves a card in my hand, and that's what he does. He's like, it was just like wowzers, you know. There's this team of advisors. I think it's going to take a bit of time because we need to take feedback from, we're going to be putting a questionnaire out probably within the week, asking for what people think. And I think we'll do quite poorly on it, actually. I think people will say, yeah, you're not transparent enough. We don't know what you're planning and so on. And then it'll be a benchmark to improve from. But what I was going to say is, when you think about that system, how it could be, how it needs to be, how I think it's going to have to be to really hold something, power is overwhelm. You know, if I've got too much power, at the minute I've got 600 messages a day coming at me or something, I can't deal with it. It's too much. So that's, I think, clearly incorrect. It clearly needs to change. But equally agreeing with you, don't want to just hand over half my job to somebody else without feeling really solid about what they can do. And so we're having this conversation about a system of mandates and roles and so on, so it's clear. And then there's a system for how the mandates get handed out, and that's based on a system that they use in Butterfield, a Buddhist festival organization in the UK. So we're going to be talking to those tomorrow. So I think it's going to take some time to find the right system, but what I keep meaning to say is it feels very prefigurative of what a future society should be organized around. I spoke to Stephen Reed about it from the Psychedelic Society, and he was, you know, just to ask what technologies are out there that we might use. And he was saying that there's blockchain technologies, I think they're called DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizing. You might know more about it, but I think there's still a little bit in beta testing, but where you might get like a sort of cryptocurrency embedded in what you're doing. And I just think, wow, I can, this, you know, this is me being a bit of a dreamer. But I think if we as a movement work this out and work out how to move in that direction, work out how to sort our shit out that gets in the way, you know, I'd love most of us to be having some therapy while we're doing this, you know, having some kind of way to look at what shadows are coming up for us in the process where, you know, I thought I had that off. If we could figure that out, excuse me. I think it would be incredible. So, yeah, it's probably the thing that most excites me at the minute.
Yeah, that's extremely exciting that your head's, I didn't know that was already a kind of a vision, part of your vision. As part of the show, we've been following the emergence of these distributed autonomous organizations or self-organizing collective intelligences, or however you want to frame it. But, you know, yeah, it seems like the actual technology is just kind of infant stage getting birthed into the world. And what I was curious about was, where would the sort of social relational space be that could hold a big enough purpose that you could apply these technologies into, that could actually organize masses of humans on behalf of a more beautiful future? And, you know, I look around the world today, it seems like it's Extinction Rebellion. You know, like y'all are holding an incredible and potential space to leverage these sorts of system architectures to allow hopefully millions of humans to do what they know in their hearts is right, but because they have to participate in systems that don't allow them to participate or to be in alignment with that understanding, you just open up a whole new octave of participation, perhaps.
Yeah, totally. And do you know what? Don't wait for the UK folks to sort this out. You know, if there's some like clever people in your networks, just go for it. You know, I mean, this is what we've done with Extinction Rebellion, is to say, tell the truth, and let's act accordingly. Name that civil disobedience is needed at this time, and we've got some principles and values, right? And that's kind of all you need to be part of Extinction Rebellion. Otherwise, maybe you're doing something else, and that's cool, you know. But if you're in for that, and you're based in, I don't know, San Diego or whatever, and you know about decentralized autonomous organizing or whatever, and you want to organize in San Diego on that basis, like, totally go for it. Because what we got to do is stop, you know, we shouldn't be waiting for me to and whoever I'm working with to figure it out. Let's have this experiment running across the world. And, you know, I think the more that people can figure out taking actions on behalf of a vision that they hold for the world going forwards, the better this is going to be. I think that's something Mickey was reminding me on a call recently. I think it's probably in, this is the nerd in me. I think it's probably in the Engler's book, This Is Not Rising. But, you know, when you make your action the thing that you're longing for, it has a different quality. So people probably saw that we shut down the bridges in London. Maybe you can, you know, check that out. And that was really awesome. We left two open because we liaised with the emergency services, and that's what we understood would keep people as safe as possible. And so that's cool, isn't it? You know, part of the longing is that this system has to stop. So you're making that a reality. And what does it mean when people, you know, it's incredible time because people were just so totally open to getting arrested. And so the police they could have done things. I think we sold our water cannons, but I guess they could have got the tear gas out. But even there, that would have looked so terrible that I guess more people would have been outraged and joined us. I mean, that's what often happens in movements when people are treated in a repressive way. So you set it up. I think it's called a dilemma action. Either way, you're willing to be arrested. And so one of the bridges in particular in London, they kept arresting people on it. And we kept sending people from the Westminster Bridge. So people kept showing up. And at some point, the police just couldn't cope with it anymore. And they go, you know, this is, well, we can't do it anymore. And so we were chanting on the Westminster Bridge, and this is how we win. This is how we win. You know, because it's like at some point the system's overwhelmed. It's not by that many of us. That's what's really awesome. When people get quite, when you're talking about climate, any kind of issue, really. In the UK, they talk about the Daily Mail readers, you know, the people who are reading maybe slightly right-wing tabloids and think that, well, they're never going to start caring about homeless people or whatever. And you know, it's not like all Daily Mail readers are bad, by the way, but the point I always make to people, if you've got real personal agency here, if you're willing to cross that line, and to me that's an initiatory process to be an ordinary person, but saying, actually, I'm done with this system, so why am I willing to be so obedient to it? You know, it's an initiation. I think it's breaking the spell of the consumerism on some level. I think it's part of that consciousness shift. So, you know, when people doing that, it then overwhelms the system. So, I mean, that came out of me talking about doing visionary things. So I went off on a bit of a tangent to tell you about the Lambeth Bridge, and I'll maybe finish on a slightly funny story about that with something else. But using the made up San Diego example, what people could do is organize around this decentralized structure and start to bring out, you know, what we did on one of the bridges. We held a citizens' assembly right in the, well, a people's assembly right in the middle of the bridge. So we did the democracy that we want to see on the bridge. And then we went back to what's called Parliament Square, which is in front of our Houses of Parliament. And there was a closing ceremony, an interfaith closing ceremony. And then these trees were brought in, and the crowd realised that we were going to be planting the trees in Parliament Square, which is a massive no-no. And the kind of, there was this, I could feel it in the crowd, this kind of longing. That's what we want, to be in charge, to make the, to heal the earth. You know, we don't want to be causing trouble on the streets. That's not really what we want. We want to be planting trees and making things better again. I know sorting out climate change involves more than that, but and it was a beautiful thing, actually. The police came to try and stop it, and the crowd just stood in the way, and it happened. And of course, it got dug up again. But the symbolism of that, so you could have a town that just keeps guerrilla tree planting over and over again until the message is there, or that kind of, you know, vision holding piece. That's what excites me, and I just really encourage people to make it their own.
Thank you, Gail. There's, as I mentioned in this conversation, you know, I myself oscillate between despair and hope and optimism. And the work that you've done with Extinction Rebellion and just what it is becoming, what I see it becoming, is, to be honest, one of the greatest sources of hope when I look out into the world stage right now for me. And I want to honor you for the part that you had in bringing it to life. And I know that, you know, it is much beyond you now, but it was also, you know, came through you. And it's quite clear in talking with you, the kind of care and sophistication and just trust, I think, that produced this phenomenon. And that makes me even more hopeful and even more of a kind of like believer in its potential. So thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing so transparently about your own perspectives.
Oh, you're really welcome. That makes me feel honored and delighted, and also slightly, you know, no pressure. I just really want everybody to feel like this is theirs, you know, because a space has been opened for all those connections that we've been wanting. And there are forces trying to pull this thing apart, you know, both within us and without, outside of us. So I just like, let's all really, we, you know, not just watch this thing, but work for, you know, work for making it work. But thank you.
Yeah. And so I encourage everybody who's listening, you know, like, don't be on the sidelines. Don't just listen to this episode. Like, look into it. Even if you're in America, like, I know I saw chapters, I think in LA, at least when I last looked, at least a Facebook group. I don't think it's really kicked off yet in America, but like, it could if you do something.
Oh, you know what? I think there was about 16 groups in America already. We have a, maybe we can put it in the thing afterwards, Daniel, but there's an email address people can write to for the international team that are helping groups get off the ground internationally. So yeah,
perfect.
We're working with the Climate Mobilization. They're supporting us to help build that both internationally and in the US in particular.
Great. Wonderful. Yeah. We'll include that in the show notes. And, great. Anything you'd like to say as parting words before we close down this particular conversation?
I was going to finish telling you the funny story from the Lambeth Bridge, which was just that, so everybody left the bridges eventually because that was the end of the day and we're going to Parliament Square. But apparently there was some hardcore group of people that, despite the fact that the police had given up, still just wanted to hold the bridge, stay in their lock and tubes and refuse to move. And the police, I didn't have the capacity to arrest them all, as I said. So they apparently were begging them to move. They were like, please, come on, we just need to get home. What can we do? What does it take to get you to move? And eventually, apparently, and this is factual, somebody piped up, I really could murder a gin and tonic. And the police officer took him to a bar and bought him a gin and tonic. So, you know, I'm just praying. It's beautiful, isn't it? I'm just really there's a lot of concern about, you know, the police could turn on us, and certainly they have on activists, and it's not an easy ride for people of colour with the police, to say the least, you know, to say the least. So I don't want to sound naive, but I just pray that it would be a beautiful thing if it could be a movement that stays with fun stories like that. Let's hope and see.
Yeah, yeah. I totally agree. I mean, that's when these social movements really tip the scales, is when the relationship to the security forces changes. And I think given the context, right, I imagine that this is more likely to tip those scales than anything I've ever seen in my lifetime, right? That this is something that includes all of us. And I think there's it would be somebody who had to be pretty insensitive, or I won't say that. It will be harder and harder to have your head in the sand when it comes to these issues. And so I think the arc of history is on this side of this work. So, yeah. Again, thank you, Gail.
Thank you. Thank you.